Support for WBFO and What's Next comes from our members and from Health Foundation for Western and Central New York, where racial and socioeconomic health equity are prioritized. Learn more about building healthier neighborhoods at hfwcny.org.
I'm Jay Moran.
I'm Bridget Jaipal Valenza.
I'm Thomas O'Neill White.
We need to get together and let our voices be heard.
This is What's Next. A dedicated hour to have important conversations about the issues facing the marginalized and underrepresented communities of Western New York and Southern Ontario.
If we're going to have some real healing, we've got to have space to tell some uncomfortable truth.
What's Next continues our mission to discuss race,
equity,
and the common concerns of Buffalo's East Side and beyond.
In the suburban area, everywhere, we must work and teach our children.
Welcome to What's Next here on WBFO, your NPR station. Very special edition today. I'm your host, Ryan Zunner, guest host for this episode of What's Next. I'm joined by Samantha Nephew of the Seneca Nation. She works at the Buffalo Center for Health Equity. Also joined by Melissa Leonard, a member of the Tonawanda Band of Seneca's programming and curriculum curator, educator, all-around advocate for Native education. Thanks so much for joining us today, guys.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah, and you know, we're here in the middle of Native American Heritage Month. I know both of you were involved in the kickoff event for that at Niagara Square, at least for the city of Buffalo, back on November 1st. Talk a little bit about, you know, what that flag raising was, the effort that it took to get that together, because this is only the second annual one, mm-hmm. I think, that we just had.
Yeah, I started it last year, and I tell people all the time that one of the reason why I started it is because the year before, I believe I was probably at a Pride event. They do their flag raising in June. And I remember looking up at it and going, why don't we have one? And so many different groups tend to have, you know, their flag raisings there and whatnot. And that question to myself was really just kind of what kicked it off. A friend of mine, Council Member Mitch Nowakowski, and I actually sat down and talked about it, and he goes, well, you got to do it now. We had like a whole hour-long conversation about what this could look like and what, you know, what the steps that I needed to take in order to do it. And back then, I was working for 1199 SEIU, and they helped me by, you know, getting all of the paperwork together and the insurance that was needed, et cetera, et cetera. And I got it started, mm-hmm. and it's a little bit of work to get it done. But when I saw the kids from Native American Magnet School 19 come in, it was worth all of the effort that it took putting that together, because so many people just appreciated seeing that happen for the first time, mm-hmm. In 2023, the first time.
Right.
But yeah, no, the effort was well worth it, mm-hmm. when I saw those kids. And I let the kids every year turn the crank thing that puts that flag
right,
actually
the flag
up.
Pole, yeah.
Yeah, the flagpole. And it's so worth it to see the look on their faces and see them represented. Like that, mm-hmm. that is, for me, the goal, right? Representation matters. And so to see that front and center with elected officials who represent us in whatever part of government that they're in, it was important for me to see them with our Native community.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, you mentioned Native Magnet School 19. Melissa, I know you used to be a teacher there, so I'm sure that holds a very special place in your heart. From the school perspective, right, because you have Native students there, you also have non-Native students that attend the school, and Native American Heritage Month is really that focal point that you can, you know, use it as an example, use as maybe a torch to talk about some Native history, but also current Native issues. So what is that Native American Heritage Month? What does it look like to you? What does it mean to you?
I think that it represents visibility. And I think it's important to distinguish, it's Native American Heritage Month to acknowledge the history, the past, but at the same time, bring that into the present. And I think what Samantha's saying about the kids being there was so important, because they often do not get to see themselves on TV or in movies or represented in a lot of ways. So any time that we can make ourselves visible in that way is really important. So I think beyond November, November's great, mm-hmm. but beyond November, I'm hoping it to be a catalyst for our presence all the time.
Mm-hmm. And does that, you know, that's obviously the impact for the Native community. You talk about that representation. What should it mean to non-Native populations when this month rolls around?
Ooh, I love this because there's some misunderstandings out there. I will say that one of the reasons why I'm so vocal is because quite a few years ago now, I think it was 2015, I want to say, I got a call from somebody who told me that they went to a book event at a local bookstore, and somebody had brought up Native Americans as part of, it was some racial justice thing. And somebody stood up and said, "Why are we talking about Native Americans? They don't even exist anymore."
Wow.
This is 2015.
Yeah. And at a place of supposed learning, right?
Yes.
A bookstore, no less.
Oh my God. When I got that call, I couldn't speak. As far as I'm concerned, at least one has been around since 1989, and that's me. So we exist. So that is one of the big things. And to that point, and that's exactly why I wanted to have the flag raising too, because it's, you know, it's multi-layered. To have that representation and see the kids see themselves in current day, you know, outside of City Hall where everybody goes and et cetera. But for non-Native students, I find myself even today, you know, challenging what people's conceptions of Native Americans are. And I swear to God, if one more person brings up the movie Pocahontas to me when we talk about that, you know, we come in all shapes and sizes and different colors. And, you know, it's just important that people recognize that, yes, I'm Native American. And no, I don't look like Pocahontas.
I think it's an element of the feathers and the stereotypes and the images that we all grow up with, that if people don't see that, then they don't equate there's no equation there. So if we're not dressing up the way that people expect us to, then there's the idea that we don't exist anymore. Mm-hmm. And I think a lot of us have had that experience where we've had to correct or explain ourselves, or it really cuts to the core of our identity, those questions and those experiences.
100%.
Is that experience like dialed up even more for, you know, especially Native youth that grow up in urban environments and maybe not on the territory, where they're trying to learn about their culture at the same time that people might be discriminating against them or upholding those negative stereotypes?
They hurt those negative stereotypes that you're talking about. They hurt the way that people see themselves. And I keep talking about kids, but I mean, myself. And seeing, I'm 35 years old, and seeing myself, you know, I love talking about Reservation Dogs. It's such a good series, and it's the closest thing. I tell people all the time, I don't have favorite anything, but that is my favorite television show. I want to say the last season, I saw my aunts and uncles in part of that series. Like, I saw my family, I saw myself. Mm-hmm. Now, I never grew up on the reservation, but you know, to see that kind of representation on something that you can stream on Hulu, like, that was awesome. And I love seeing that, and it lends credence to the urban natives that we're talking about, because I don't go to the reservation every day. I can't. But to see that in a place where it's just so, so stupendously done, you know, I love seeing that.
And, you know, we talk about, you know, creating that greater dialogue, and shows like Reservation Dogs certainly do that, right?
Mm-hmm.
You can enjoy it as a Native person. You can enjoy it as a non-Native person,
mm-hmm.
or maybe that's the catalyst where, you know, you bring in your non-Native friends and family and show them that and say, you know, this is a representation of who we are. You know, it also has to do with the classroom. It has to do with programming, things like that. Melissa, how do you create that dialogue that properly teaches the history of Native people. But at the same time, we talked about before, continuing on, making sure that, you know, it's known that Native people are still here.
I think that it needs to start from a place of empathy. And I think stories are the best way to tell that. I think for far too long, it's been in this year, this happened. And it tends to center around a long time ago, the Trail of Tears. And that happened away from us somewhere else. And we don't bring to the forefront people and humanize it. And so I think that the first way to tell that story to kids is from a human perspective and tell individual stories of how people were affected. And I think one element of that story is I'm trying to do is bring to the forefront what happened in Buffalo and how the Senecas were removed, so that we can bring the story to a point where we can feel what other people felt instead of this is what happened and leave it at that, because we are still feeling the effects of that history as Native people in the present day. And so just making that connection between it happened to people, our families, our ancestors, it humanizes it, and then you can feel empathy for that story.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, I know a lot of your work in the last couple of years has focused on the Seneca Indian Park in South Buffalo. And a lot of people don't know that, you know, there's a Native burial ground right in a city park, and the general public will probably have no idea about it. Talk a bit about how you got involved in that and kind of where we're at today.
So I grew up a few blocks away from Seneca Indian Park. And for people who don't know, it's in South Buffalo off of Seneca Street between Buffum Street and Indian Church Road. It's a really small parcel of land that has Native remains there today. And I researched the history of the park because I started with the question, how did a burial grounds rather become a city park? And then that opened the door to the larger history of the Buffalo Creek Reservation and what happened to the Senecas, which I didn't have an answer to that. I knew that Haudenosaunee people lived in Buffalo and the Buffalo Creek Treaty was signed and then they left, and I didn't really understand how did that happen. So I started to research beyond that history, and I learned that the park was used as a burial grounds for hundreds and hundreds of years, going back to before the Haudenosaunee people lived here, where there were other groups, the Wenros, the Eries, the Neutrals, and those remains were in the park. And then the Senecas lived in that area, and that was the hub of Buffalo Creek, and used it also as a cemetery. And then it was donated to the city as a park, protested by the Senecas, who did not want it turned into a park. And that story has remained untold. And so I've been focusing on that, asking for some recognition of the important piece of our history that still is present in that park, and also change in order to acknowledge how that the Senecas were removed, and that was a piece of the past that I don't think is a story that's been told yet.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, the UB's Indigenous Studies program, they have that land-based learning program. And part of that was going to that park and hearing the history from you to them. Talk about how impactful conversations like that can be to get, you know, your project across the finish line there of getting that recognition.
So I think anyone who's willing to listen to the story, that's a first step in itself. Simply just listen to our story. And I think what we're beginning to do, especially with UB's Indigenous Studies program, is tell the story ourselves. Mm-hmm. And I think that's the really important piece of it, because history has been written by non-Native men for the most part. And so it's important to me that we learn our history and learn our place and then tell that story ourselves.
Mm-hmm. And you know, part of that history for Native people obviously includes the residential boarding school system over 150 years on both the U.S. and Canada, subjecting Native children to be torn away from their families, their identity, you know, malnutrition, deaths, things like that. What kinds of long-term effects are still being felt today in Native communities with residential schools? Because they existed all the way into the 1960s, 70s in Canada up until the early 90s, I believe.
Well, we are sitting here speaking English, first of all. I know very little Seneca, and I feel it. There's that connection that's missing. Mm-hmm. And I guess to an extent, I carry a little blame because I don't put in more effort to learn the language, but also I don't really have the opportunity because it's so lost. And something that I had mentioned at the flag raising was actually, if you know a Native person, you know someone who's been affected by these boarding schools. My great grandmother Thelma was in one of those schools. I believe it was Carlisle. But you know, when you hear, oh my God, and there's a great episode on Reservation Dogs about this. I don't know if you've seen it, but it goes into like what it felt being torn away from your home and then hearing basically gibberish, because that's what English sounded like to Native speaking kids. You know, there are people who fell into like a mass depression, I imagine. People were torn away from their families, lost their culture, beaten if they spoke their language. And then oftentimes kids died at these schools. We lost entire generations of people to these schools. And, you know, I'm sure my parents felt it. They've since passed, but I'm pretty sure they felt it. And when we talk about long-term health outcomes, we know that, you know, missing culture is culture is absolutely a social determinant of health. And so people lost a lot of, you know, what they could, how they saw themselves. Mm-hmm. And then that turns into, you know, other health issues. You know, addiction is a big thing in our community, and I think it's closely tied to these schools and what happened to our elders and our ancestors at this point.
Drugs and alcohol, I mean, that's a go-to coping mechanism for a lot of people, especially dealing with the trauma like that. You know, you touched on it too, that sort of loss of a family in a way, right? My grandfather was in the Mohawk Institute, the Mushroll up in Six Nations. He described it as an orphanage, not as a school for as long as you're alive, because the idea of it was that they instilled in you that you had no family. The school was your family. The government or church was your family now.
Yeah.
And you lose that family unit element. You know, he was, you know, able to overcome that and, you know, raise a great family and things like that. But for so many people on Native territories, you know, they maybe don't know how, you know, to be a father or mother because they lost their father or mother in a way because of these schools.
Right.
That has to have a long-term impact for cycles of trauma and whatnot.
I mean, when you think about it, this is where the, well, I actually don't know if this is where it started, but the kill the Indian, save the man phrase is, I mean, it's perfectly put right there.
Yeah.
They didn't see us as people. They saw us as something that needed to be saved. This is why I tend to get a little triggered when I hear the term assimilation. And you hear people say that about, you know, incoming immigrants today, and I'm like, no, because this is how the Indian boarding schools happened. This is just basically our entire history, in the history of the United States. I mean, this is where it was.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's easier to treat people terribly when you dehumanize them,
mm-hmm.
and in learning the history through my own research the last 2 years, I'm realizing that tactic was used in the way that we were described. And when the land was sought after by settlers, we are described in primary documents by people of the time as, you know, savages and
it's
criminals.
A constitution.
Yeah. And it's easier to remove people, treat them terribly when you don't think of them as human. And what I've been learning about the land is that, you know, it was sought after. That's where removal took place, and we were put on reservations. And then the next tactic was, well, what do we do now? Because for one thing, Native sent out west, settled in, and then that land was sought after for gold. And so it was, we were in the way again. So now, you know, you get into stories of genocide and other tactics to try to deal with what I've read in a lot of documents is, quote, an Indian problem. And New York State had an assembly in the late 1800s, a committee called the New York State Committee on the Indian Problem, because we were on reservations and on, you know, designated territories, and we still were considered a problem. And the boarding schools were born out of that idea, because when we were still considered a problem, the land was taken, the boarding schools were the next step for how to deal with us. And one thing that I didn't realize till fairly recently reading about the boarding schools was that in a lot of cases, the kids were used as leverage. You won't see your kids again if you don't sign this over. You don't sign this treaty. And I never realized that till fairly recently. But it just seems that it was just one thing after another that we were up against in history, starting with the land and then, you know, our kids and so on and so forth. But I think the boarding schools, bring it back to what you were saying, Samantha, about the dehumanizing. You can get into the history with the boarding schools when mascots started, and how our kids were in schools being told you can't have your culture, you can't speak your language. But then sports teams said, well, we're going to take what we like from your culture and we're going to use it to root for our sports teams. So there's just that dehumanizing factor goes back a long time in history, back to the doctrine of discovery, all the way to the present with stereotypes and mascots. It's just a continued idea that we've been up against.
Mm-hmm. And I'm sure that dehumanization factor really affects, I mean, your personal identity and how you express that. Samantha, I'm sure that, you know, doesn't create the best mental health outcomes for people.
Absolutely not. I mean, I'll talk about my dad real quick. He was adopted by an Italian family on the east side of Buffalo. And he knew he was adopted before he knew he was Cayuga. I'm pretty sure that is what led to a series of issues that he had in his younger life. He told me as much when I was in high school, I believe. He passed away shortly after. But he told me that it really messed him up on the inside to know that he has this Native background and he wasn't an Italian dude from the east side of Buffalo. Mm-hmm. And he told me, you know, he told me stories about how he dealt with that. He moved away to New York City, whole discovery of self. But it took a long time for him to reconcile the fact that the first 18 years of his life, he didn't know he was Native.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's that factor of like, you know, why was that hidden for so long? Like, why, you know, why do you have to, especially with the adoption, you talk about the child welfare system and Native communities have been, you know, victims of that. That could just be that alone. The your indigeneity is the reason why that you have to be adopted to a different family or assimilated or things like that.
I mean, it's heartbreaking for me because I have a really strong foundation. I am a Seneca woman and I know this. my parents made it a priority in our house, to know that and to feel it and to be it. So when I think about my dad and what he had to go through in order to really be himself and feel himself,
find himself,
it's heartbreaking. And there, I'm sure there are still people out there who struggle with this. Mm-hmm. I'm sure that there are people out there who have no idea that they're Native because this is what happened.
Yeah.
This is how you solve the Indian problem, as Melissa was saying, is you just assume you're not.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And how do Native people fight back against that? What needs to happen? What maybe has been happening? Is it that sort of extra effort put into learn things like language, connect with relatives, stand strong on, you know, sovereignty issues for Native territories. Does that all kind of play a factor in that?
I think it's all of that, but I also think it's healing, and it's starting with our own healing individually and then as a community. And I think that the reservation system and boarding schools, it really disconnected us from each other and our community, and that was intentional, because we are not meant to live that way. And so I think by acknowledging the trauma and just working on healing together, that's a really good foundation for everything else that you talked about, learning languages and learning how to dance and trying to get back to those cultural roots. But I think at the center of it is our own work in healing from what has happened.
Yeah, I mean, specifically, I personally find a lot of healing in just creating this community. Melissa and I just met this year.
Oh, wow.
But it feels like, it feels like I've known you quite some time, but it's only been like the last couple of months. But this is how I feel connected to my culture in a way, is just being able to sit down and have conversations with other Native people who get, you know, the feeling of being invisible, who get, you know, we were talking about Tom Porter. He was at the Western New York Peace Dinner. Mm-hmm. He was the keynote speaker. And there's a certain humor to elders in our community. And he represented that perfectly. And I was at a table full of Indigenous women who just got the humor. I tend to have to explain, like, almost the dryness of our humor. And I don't really want to call it that, but there is. Mm. And it's hilarious and I love it, but I didn't have to explain that to the group that I was with. You know, I don't mind explaining things about our community, because I tend to be in a lot of different, specifically African American communities and whatnot, and I have to explain things, and that's fine. I don't mind. But to be at a table where I didn't have to, that was healing in and of itself. So I hear what you're saying about just being with each other. I mean,
and laughing is healing,
because we get it though, mm-hmm. and it's awesome to be in that space. Mm-hmm. And you know, I know a few words in Seneca here and there. I feel connected to the land because this is, you know, where our people were from. Mm-hmm. But that community part is really the best thing I think we can do at any given time.
I can't wait to dive more into that topic. Definitely going to be a topic of discussion. We're going to go to our first break right now, but don't go anywhere. You're listening to What's Next on WBFO.
Many Buffalo Toronto Public Media members have contributed for 40 years or more, and they want the programming they love to be here for the next generation. You can help sustain the future of great programming by naming Buffalo Toronto Public Media as a beneficiary of your retirement plan. To learn more, contact Lisa LaTravato at 716-845-7031.
Hey, parents and caregivers. Want to help your child stay on track at school? Then check out Reading Rainbow Stories. Visit readingrainbow.org or the Reading Rainbow YouTube channel today.
We at Buffalo Toronto Public Media take pride in bringing you your favorite national programs like Fresh Air, All Things Considered, and Morning Edition. But what makes WBFO so special are its local programs, learning together about how government works in bite-sized pieces on Compact Civics with host Corey McCamps.
Here's a quick guide on polling locations. A polling place is where you cast your ballot during elections. In America, the term polling place refers to the building, while polling station refers to the specific room or area where voting happens.
And diving into pop culture and local happenings on Group Chat with host Bentley and a revolving panel of friends in the know.
I really miss having to actually wait to tune in for a show and be there at the certain time, like having to run home and like turn on the TV at a certain time to like watch your show.
Yeah. Like more national unity then too.
Yes.
Like we're because, all
you know,
turned
everybody
in.
Is watching at the same time, and you can like call and
ever
say,
since
did you see
streaming
what
has just gone downhill.
This is public media.
You're listening to What's Next our place to discuss the important issues of our communities of Western New York and Southern Ontario. We want to hear from you. Click on the Talk to Us option in the WBFO app, and we will work to get your questions or comments on the air. If you have a story or concern that we should be addressing, email us using whatsnext@wbfo.org. Together, we'll have the conversations that are needed. This is WBFO, your NPR station.
Welcome back to What's Next here on WBFO. I'm your guest host for this episode, Ryan Zunner. I'm joined by Samantha Nephew and Melissa Leonard here. And we're talking all things Indigenous, all things Native American here for Native American Heritage Month. And before we went to break, you guys were talking about that Western New York Peace Center dinner that you were at, where Tom Porter, longtime storyteller and elder in the Haudenosaunee community, he was one of the keynote speakers. And you guys talked about, you know, even though serious topics were discussed, there's still that element of like humor and laughter that just seems so unique to the Native community.
I when you say that, I love this because I mentioned that my parents have passed, but whenever I meet anybody out in the community, one of the things, if they knew my parents, one of the things that they mention is how funny they were. Mm. And I love that. I love knowing that they made people laugh. And we were mentioning during the break about how healing laughter is. And I see it in our community. When we come together for just about anything, there's always humor. And sometimes it's at the expense of stereotypes, kind of using it to make jokes. But there's just a seeing an elder laugh. My great aunt Sue, she lives down in Salamanca. When I see her laugh, it's just so much joy in it. You know, we've talked about some pretty serious topics here, and it's harmful. But when you come together and you just laugh, it's so much fun. A little biased here. Native humor is the best, but you know, it's so great to be around.
We also went to recently see Tommy Orange with the Babel series.
Okay.
And Tommy Orange is a Native author who wrote They're There, and his newer book is Wandering Stars. But what was interesting about the lecture, and I've been to several of them, I've never laughed so much to see an author speak, and he really encapsulated exactly what we're talking about. He was talking about the heavy themes of his books, but he had funny stories to go along with it. So I think it's just a central theme of when we get together as Native people, there's a lot of laughing.
Mm-hmm. And you know, that sense of community is so important, again, because, you know, we talk about the residential boarding school system trying to take away that community. That was really, I mean, the goal, as we said, kill the Indian, save the man, much more than a metaphor, actuality there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, to know that my family has been through what they've been through in the past, but still come out and still laugh. Like, I'm sitting here thinking, like, I have these key core memories, basically, from when I was younger. And it's almost always centered around laughing. And I love that. You know, like I mentioned, my great grandmother, she went to one of those boarding schools. And yet not for some reason, but I can almost hear her laughing in my head right now. Mm. And I think that is just beautiful. And that's how I remember, you know, my family. We're talking about Native American Heritage Month and all of this, but first and foremost, we're human beings. And I just hear laughter in, you know, the family events and things of that nature. Yeah, it's just, we're on the radio. You can't see me, but I got a smile on my face because that's all I'm thinking of right now is just those.
Samantha is smiling. I will stand by that.
Is those family events. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And to sort of transition here, you know, we had, you know, President Biden make that apology a few weeks ago about the Native residential boarding schools around the United States and the history there. Do apologies like that mean something to you when it comes from somebody like the president, or is there much more that could be done, or you know?
It means there's a conversation started. I think that's what it means. It's nice that he did it, but there's so much more that needs to be involved with it.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that it really needs to center around allowing the story to be told and taught.
The real story.
The real to youth. And I think this is where Canada has made different strides, because they have mandated the teaching of the boarding school era in the curriculum in the schools. And I think that will be a much more difficult step here, even having the president apologize for it. But I think that acknowledgement hopefully has actionable steps following it.
Right. Right. You talk about, you know, the educational system obviously set up very much differently here in the United States as compared to Canada. And I wonder if that residential school legacy still has impacts on maybe a stigma towards maybe higher education or educational system. Is that something you have to overcome as an educator in Native communities? Is that history?
Yes. And I think that the larger component of it is not only educating, but our own identities and how it has affected all of us in how we identify ourselves. I think there's a lot of shame there felt. And I think that acknowledging the boarding schools in a school setting has to first work through those steps of shame. So how are we going to teach this? How are teachers going to be able to have that conversation? So I guess going back to when you asked about the president apologizing, maybe that is that first step in how are we going to now have this conversation across the board amongst ourselves as Native people, and then in schools with kids who need to learn about this history. There's not an easy answer to that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And, you know, Deb Holland, when she put together, you know, her report, you know, she was hailed as, you know, the first Native woman in a presidential cabinet. I think she maybe even had a hard time putting in an exact number or action items. You know, there's so many things in there because, I mean, the school system affected all, you know, tribes the same, but, you know, differently. And it's important to recognize, too, that, you know, each tribe and each nation is separate with their own issues that they have going on. Some are, you know, doing better than others. What do those next steps look like? What do you think they should look like?
That's a good question. It's going to require some thought.
I think that some of the next steps need to prioritize Native people and mental health. In that sense, if we're going to tell the larger story to a non-Native population, we also have to take care of ourselves at the same time. And so some of these conversations, acknowledgments of the boarding school era coming up are going to stir up a lot for Native people still feeling the effects of it. So I think we need to prioritize our mental health and in how we can help each other heal from that is probably one of the first steps.
And, you know, some of those mental health, you know, inequities, you know, Native Americans unfortunately face a really high, you know, suicide rate, depression rates, things like that. Those health inequities, I should say, where does that stem from, Samantha? Is it partially the residential school legacy, but some other factors as well?
It's all of history, it feels like. We're talking about health inequities. I mean, this is part of the reason why representation is so important, right? When you look at a lot of data I'm really heavily involved in politics and whatnot. And when you see a racial breakdown in voting trends, we're almost always listed as other. Mm-hmm. Almost always.
There was that famous meme, I think, from CNN's broadcast in 2020 that had other. Yeah. And it was like, oh, that's us. You
know? Yeah, the others. And so what I try to do is make sure that, you know, we list Native Americans, even though we just said there's a diverse, extremely diverse array of tribal nations in the U.S. and Canada. I think there's 560-something recognized tribes by the federal government. And so when you look at that, I mean, If you look at somebody, I don't know what tribes are in California or Washington, but they're going to be way different than Haudenosaunee mm-hmm. people here. And I think that it's important to recognize that, we have our own specific issues. Mental health is a good one. I don't think it's talked about enough in our community. But there's going to be different solutions for different problems. And I think that that's important to know that, you know, I'm worthy, me, myself, Melissa here, mm-hmm. we're all worthy of knowing, having data that reflects what we go through, because that data is what is used to solve problems. And we have a lot of problems. So we need to be included in those conversations, which is something that I actually try to do with my job, mm-hmm. Because the Buffalo Center for Health Equity focuses on a lot of issues within the Black community. Rightfully so, there's a lot. But I'm the voice in the back going, and Native Americans,
yeah,
and us.
do you think the Native community, especially like, I guess, in urban environments where, you know, your Buffalo Center is focused, is it a lot of the same issues that the African American community is going through that indigenous people do?
I mean, I think it all stems a lot from poverty. Poverty is a huge, indicator of health outcomes. And we tend to have the same issues in that regard.
You talked about representation mattering earlier. You talked about those conversations and how we combat some of those negative health outcomes. How important is it that Native people lead that charge, right? I mean, you have things like the Federal Indian Health Service and health centers like that, which for years and years predominantly had, you know, white doctors and nurses. There was issues with the Indian health system itself in, you know, in the 50s and 60s and things with things like forced sterilization and other, yeah. you know, medical experiments. You know, are we at the point now where Native American people can take charge and really help the communities in that sense and be more powerful for their communities?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I travel down to the res for all of my medical needs because the practitioner that I see is a Native woman. And I don't get that anywhere here in Buffalo. So I make that trip for whenever I need medical services. And my therapist is a Native woman. And so there's a level of understanding. What I mentioned earlier, I don't have to explain things. Mm-hmm. I just get to be. And with those healthcare professionals, it's the same thing. I don't have to explain a Native experience mm-hmm. because they get it. They are Native women as well. So... And that is powerful. Like, even just hearing myself say that out loud, that is powerful. There's a reason why people look for themselves in people in healthcare professionals. There's a reason why a Black woman is going to open up more to another Black woman who's a therapist or things of that nature. So that for me personally, that has been worked really well for my personal healthcare. And I think that that's important for a lot of Native people.
And I'm sure that representation can matter in a lot of instances. You know, education. How important is it a Native student gets taught an education for, you know, I mean, you know, your basic math, science, things like that. But also when we talk about the history of Native American people.
So it's exactly right. My father taught at School 19. I didn't, but he did. And he was the teacher at the school who would be present for pre-K through eighth grade. This was the early 2000s, and then his position was cut, and then it was brought back. So I think it's really important that we prioritize Native teachers and education and make sure that is part of the budget overall, because I've seen such changes in the Native resource program due to budget cuts. I think it's important that there's language instruction mm-hmm. For kids. And again, that's another element of it was cut for a while and now it's back. And so there's just, I think for Native youth, we need consistency and focus on them and prioritize them in that way.
Alrighty, great. Thanks so much, guys. We're going to take our second break here, but don't go anywhere. You're listening to What's Next here on WBFO.
Did you know that WNED PBS is always working on great new local shows for you to watch? Documentaries like Kleinhand's Gift to Buffalo, which tells the story of Buffalo's Music Hall.
The hall is very intimate, and that intimacy makes everyone who comes in here feel a part of our family.
Fun and educational series like Compact Science.
Believe it or not, peppers are technically fruits.
And Shakespeare's greatest hits, featuring some of his best-known soliloquies and monologues.
We are such stuff as dreams are made of.
You can watch them all on our website at wned.org/local shows. While you're there, check out the show pages and mini websites for additional content such as bonus features, photo galleries, and lesson plans. Find it all at wned.org/local shows. Where do you go when you want news you can trust? WBFO, of course. And when you just want to catch up on the day's news, you can go to the WBFO Brief Podcast. Listen to the WBFO Brief every weekday wherever you get your podcasts. Don't forget to like and subscribe so you can always stay up to date with the news you need.
Did you know that Buffalo Toronto Public Media produces shows that earn New York Emmy nominations and awards, Webby Awards, Telly Awards, GLAAD nominations, and New York State Broadcaster Association Awards? Check out our award-winning productions like Compact Science, Compact History, Let's Go, Brave Spaces, Kleinhand's Gift to Buffalo, and much more on the Buffalo Toronto Public Media YouTube channel or visit WNED.org. This is public media.
Hey, parents and caregivers. Let Reading Rainbow Stories help your child stay on track with their studies. Teach your child to shatter stereotypes with amazing grace.
There's no doubt who would be Peter Pan. Everyone voted for Grace.
Yay! You were fantastic, whispered Natalie.
Or about how bats and birds are different with Stella Luna.
Why are you hanging upside down? You're a bat. You're supposed to hang by your feet.
Or about how to preserve family legacies with a patchwork quilt.
Yes, your mama can get you a quilt from any department store, but it won't be like my patchwork quilt. And it won't last as long either.
Visit readingrainbow.org or the Reading Rainbow YouTube channel today.
Our mission at Buffalo Toronto Public Media is to serve our local community. And on WBFO, we do that by keeping you informed and connected to your community, whether it's by hearing from a local Black poet about what it was like to move from the inner city to the suburbs on What's Next.
So that emotional change with that culture change combined led me realize that basketball and being physical wasn't enough. I needed a way to figure out my emotions. So the first poem I wrote in the cafeteria was of Sweet Home Middle School was Outcast.
Or it's exploring the East Side Garden Walk.
It's wonderful that we're seeing engagement in beautification and sharing gardens, because we believe that we can build more vibrant communities by sharing our gardens, by sharing our stories, and by building real connections between people. We came through as neighbors and cleaned this space out and began plot by plot putting plants in.
This is Public Media.
You're listening to What's Next, our place to discuss the important issues of our communities of Western New York and Southern Ontario. We want to hear from you. Click on the Talk to Us option in the WBFO app, and we will work to get your questions or comments on the air. Do you have a story or concern that we should be addressing? Email us using whatsnext@wbfo.org. Together, we'll have the conversations that are needed. This is WBFO, your NPR station.
And welcome back to this episode of What's Next. I'm your host, Ryan Zunner, and we're here with Samantha Nephew and Melissa Leonard, still talking all things Native American Heritage Month. We've, you know, discussed the residential school legacy. We've talked about Melissa's work at the Seneca Indian Park in South Buffalo. We've talked health outcomes, so many great points of conversation here. And as we're kind of in our last segment, I want to ask both of you, you know, you've done the work this month. You've seen kind of what everyone else is doing for Native American Heritage Month. What do you see, not to steal from the title of the show, but what's next? What needs to be done more to make sure Native American Heritage Month has that impact and matters?
Continue these conversations, honestly. I think that that's critically important. I don't think we talk about it enough, even within our own community, about what we can do next? What's next? You know, I think having this level of pride that we have, the flag raising, going back to that again, one of my favorite things that I said was that I didn't want to have a moment of silence for the people that we lost in residential schools. That was part of the opening remarks that I made. I didn't want to have a moment of silence because we've been silenced enough. Mm-hmm. We need to be loud. We need to have our points of view. We need to have, you know, the discussion of the real history, mm-hmm. Of this country. And I think it's just continuing these conversations, asserting ourselves, like I mentioned earlier, when we talk about health inequities in the city of Buffalo, we have a pretty substantial Native population in the city, and we just need to remember to include them, you know. Mm-hmm. And I think
not cast it into that other category.
We're more than just others. Mm-hmm. You know, the history of this country likes to other us pretty consistently, and you know, this is the way that I honor our ancestors, is being able to be loud and vocal and, you know, make sure that we're included in the conversation.
Mm-hmm. One of the reasons why I focused on Seneca Indian Park is because of the origin story of the park, where it was a burial grounds that the city turned into a park. And what happened in between there was the Larkin family purchased the parcel and donated it to the city. But there's old newspapers that talk about the Senecas showed up at the ceremony, and there was a young woman named Floretta Poudry who wanted to give a speech speaking against turning it into a park. And the Senecas there were not given any seats at the ceremony. They were kept away from it. They didn't want to hear what Floretta Poudry had to say. And I think it's an example of being silenced for a very long time. And I think with Native American Heritage Month, it's giving us platforms for having conversations that we were not ever asked before. No one ever asked before. And so I think, you know, this month, it's really great that we are giving these platforms, our voices are being heard. But what I want to see is it continue on all year long. And my dad used to talk about when he was teaching and giving lectures and invited to speak at places, he would call from, you know, what was then Columbus Day to Thanksgiving, he'd call it Indian season. And he would joke. But the reality is, he'd say, I'm getting all these phone calls and, you know, I can't be in all these places for that month. And I'm here all year long. And he was right, because it was, you know, it was, we get the phone calls in November, but I want to see the phone calls all year long. Mm-hmm. So that we are thought of beyond this time of year. And I don't want to put this month down in any way, because it is important, but I want it to be a larger opportunity for our authentic voices to be heard.
Mm-hmm. Some might say Native American Heritage Month is every month.
It's every month in my house.
Yeah, I mean, I guess I always like to sort of wrap up, you know, when I do, you know, typical news interviews, asking the person, is there anything that you want to talk about that I didn't ask? So I'm going to use that here for what's next. Is there anything you'd like to say that maybe I didn't ask about?
I think Melissa actually said the word that doesn't get talked about enough, but not to end on a really dreary note, but the word genocide.
Mm.
People don't believe that what happened here was a genocide. That is something that I've encountered personally, you know, especially older white men, for some reason, like to fight with me about that word.
Right, that downplaying.
Yeah,
of it. Yeah.
Like as if, I mean, if you look at I think it's the UN definition of genocide, we fit all those categories, you know, loss of culture, loss of land.
Right. There's an attack on youth, right?
Yep,
remove that element.
Yep. Yep, all of that. And I think that's, you know, it's heavy, but it's important to know that, well, one, we are survivors, Melissa, and you, you know, we're survivors of genocide. And I think that is an important conversation that needs to be had as well.
Melissa?
Agreed. And I think the ultimate message in that would be, you know, we need to learn our history in general. And I think that it lends itself to the resiliency, that, you know, if we can acknowledge that genocide occurred, that this history happened, it can help us move forward to acknowledge we're resilient and we still have each other and our culture and our language, despite all of this that has happened.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, conversations playing a super important role in continuing that dialogue. I want to thank you, Samantha Nephew and Melissa Leonard, for joining us here on What's Next for Today. Thanks for listening.
Nyawe.
Nyawe.
Support for WBFO and What's Next comes from our members and from Health Foundation for Western and Central New York, where racial and socioeconomic health equity are prioritized. Learn more about building healthier neighborhoods at hfwcny.org.